Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from Silicon Valley Bank. My name is Tom Verton. As a third generation venture capitalist, Tim Draper is a longtime advocate for entrepreneurs and free markets. He is the founder and managing director of Draper Fisher Jurvetson and managing director of DFJ Global Network. And with over $5 billion in capital commitments, DFJ's impressive portfolio includes investments in companies like Skype, Hotmail, Overture, Meebo, Tesla Motors, and Glam Media. Tim was named Always On's number one top venture capital dealmaker for 2008, and as well as ranked number seven on Forbes' Midas list. He has served on numerous boards, including the Dean's Advisor Board for Harvard Business School and the board of UC Berkeley's Haas Business School of Business. Tim was a global member of Singapore's International Economic Council and the Ukraine's Orange Circle. Tim is the course creator and chairman of BizWorld, a nonprofit organization that develops programs to teach children about business, entrepreneurship, and finance, and writes for his blog, TheRiskMaster.com. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tim Draper. Tim?
Terrific. Well, thank you very much, Tom. That's a wonderful introduction. If you wonder why I'm limping on this thing, it was a beach volleyball accident, and I'm still trying to take risks out there, but I'm getting a little old for it. What do these Silicon Valley companies have in common? Intel, Sun, eBay, WebEx, Google, Yahoo. Well, they all had foreign-born founders. And what do these companies have in common? Athena Health, Baidu, Yandex, Focus Media, Skype. They're all billion-dollar VC wins outside of the Silicon Valley. So globalization's on the rise. The biggest buildings in Dubai, the biggest airlines in Europe, the biggest oil refinery is in, I can't read these things fast enough, but Bollywood's bigger than Hollywood, richest man's in Mexico. There's one thing that's for sure. The world is opening up. We used to have a little bit of a monopoly here in the Silicon Valley on entrepreneurship, and now it's everywhere. So whatever you do, wherever you go, whatever you're focused on, think globally. Now I'm going to take you through some of my trials and tribulations and maybe lessons learned, although I don't learn very well. It turns out I just keep doing the same stupid things over and over and over. But anyway, I'll start with Russia. My first experience with Russian entrepreneurs was in Boston, where I funded Sam Geisberg, and he helped build one of the great software companies of the East Coast, Parametric Technology. But I've had a series of other experiences in Russia. One was an investor in Yukos Oil. And Yukos Oil, it was selling for $35 a share, and I thought, wow, that's really cheap. It's about a 4 PE. And all of a sudden, it went to zero. And I thought, what? Where did that go? Apparently, it was nationalized. And then I had an opportunity to go back to Russia with my Russian translator, who actually, while he was translating to me, he turned to the other guy, listened to him speak Russian, then he turned to me and he started speaking Russian to me as though, you know, I would understand what was going on. But I don't think I did understand what was going on because they said that they had a $50 million fund ready for us and we were ready to go. And then Khodorkovsky got put into prison and that money just disappeared. So we don't know what happened to that money. Then we had another experience in Russia where we set up a fund with VTB Bank, and that fund we thought was sort of a partnership, but it turned out VTB Bank sort of took it over, and there was a little bit of fraud in there, and we had to sort of back away. And so now we think it's maybe third time's a charm. We're setting up another fund with VTB Bank and Russ Nano, and looking forward to great things. Now, the reason I keep going in Russia is they've had 75 years where entrepreneurship was illegal, and that's almost four generations of no entrepreneurs and, in fact, punishment to run a business, start a business, build a business. And so they have to overcome that. That is that whole population is extraordinarily well-educated. They're great science and technology people, and we're hoping for the best that eventually we can sort of turn the tide and Russia becomes a major contributor to the world economy. So then I'm going to take you to India. My dad started the first venture fund in India, and that was back in 1995. But at about the same time, we funded, at Draper Fisher Jurvetson, we funded two young entrepreneurs, one of which was Indian, and they came up with this free web-based email idea. And they said, yeah, we're going to give it away free. And then I kind of said, but then what? And they said, well, you know, we'll just give it away free, make it up on volume or something. And then they got it up, and it was working, and it was wonderful. And then I said, how are you going to get this out to everybody? And they said, well, we'll put up billboards on 101, we'll have TV ads, and we'll have... And I'm saying, wait a second, you're a startup. We only gave you about $150,000. How are you going to do all this? And they didn't really respond. And I said, well, how about, can't you just get it out to all those people on the web? And they said, no, that would be spamming. So that was a new word for me. And I said, well, wait, you're giving this thing away free. Can't you just tell everybody, get your, you know, I said, how about if we put something that says, P.S., I love you, get your free email at Hotmail on the bottom of everybody's email. And they thought, oh, God, all the investors in the world, why did we end up with this one? And then eventually they came around, and I kept pushing, and they said, okay, we will do it, but no P.S. I love you. To this day, I believe we would have had a much more peaceful and loving world if they had kept it in. But in any case, it spread very quickly, 11 million users in 18 months, and the first email that went... Sabir Bhatia was the founder, and he sent one email to his friend in India. And within 3 weeks, we had 100,000 registered Hotmail users in India. And India was like another planet at that time. And I knew that this was the beginning. Geographic borders were going to fall. Business was going to get done across all the way around the world. Things were really starting to happen. I'm going to tell you another quick story about India because... since then, we've built a partnership in India, and things are going very well. My partner said, so, Tim, you ready to cross the street? I said, yeah, I guess. Meanwhile, you know, there's a cow coming this way and motorcycles shooting this way and guys on bikes with wagons behind them going another way and a few cars and people walking and taking their elephants. And I'm kind of going, okay, I'll make it across. And so I walk halfway across the street, you know, and just kind of barely make it. And then I see an opening, and I run across the street, and my partner goes, no! And I said, what? He said, no sudden movements. And so everyone in India is doing differential calculus as they move through the world. And I thought, well, that's why all the software engineers are so good there. So now I'm going to take you to China. My dad took me to China and back in, what was it, 1986, 87. And he was with the UN at the time. And we arrived in the airport in Beijing, and we drove in the only car on the only paved road to the only Americanized hotel where, you know, I knew how to go to the bathroom, that kind of thing. And everybody was on bicycles, and everybody was passing fruit around, and it was a great, fun experience. And then you fast forward about 15 years, and I went back to China, and I went from Shanghai to Hangzhou in a very long car ride, and I was bored, and I was looking out the window, and I saw all of these two-story concrete tilt-ups. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. I guess that's how they all lived, you know, a billion people all living in two-story concrete tilt-ups. And then all of a sudden I saw one with blue windows and a spire and a paved driveway. And I thought, wow, it must be like the mayor or something. And then I went a little farther, and I saw another one, blue windows, a spire, and a driveway. And then I saw a whole street of blue windows, spires, and driveways. And I thought, whoa, this is like Keeping Up with the Joneses in the 1950s in the U.S. There, if the guy next door is going to get a blue window, I'm going to get a blue window. If he's going to get a refrigerator, I'm going to get a refrigerator. If he's going to get Wi-Fi, I'm going to get Wi-Fi. And so I thought, gee, okay, now we're going to really invest in China. And then I found out that, you know, this guy had built a $90 million chocolate company, an American, built a $90 million chocolate company in China, and it was nationalized. And I thought, boy, this is going to be interesting. It's going to be a little risky. I don't know. And I remember talking to a minister and saying, you know, if you let a few people make money here, a lot more money's going to come. And I think he was listening, but he only spoke Chinese. There was a translator. And then I came back, I don't know, a couple of years later, and we had set up a fund, and we could invest in China and other places. And so we invested in these three companies. Each one was, you know, it's got great government connections and this, that, and the other. And we thought, okay, well, we'll put some money into that. All that money just disappeared. It was gone. Then we thought, well, what do we really do? Well, we fund young, driven entrepreneurs very excited about what they're doing, and they want to change the way the world works. And let's see if we can find some of them. And then we funded Baidu and Kongzhong and Focus Media, and all of a sudden it happened. And China took off, and boy, now when you walk around the streets of Beijing, they're walking around like the New Yorkers used to walk in 1980, with this great pride and great excitement, and the people in China are pushing the edge. They are trying things you don't even dare to think about here in the Silicon Valley. So we'll stay tuned. I'll talk a little more about that. Now I'm going to take you to Estonia. But on that trip, first I went through Ukraine, and I noticed, and I met the president of Ukraine, the Yushchenko, the guy who got poisoned. Anyway, I said, you know, why would I ever do business here? You've got, it takes 25 bureaucrats and 6 months for anybody to even start a business here. And he said, next time you come, it will be two bureaucrats and 1 week. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. They're starting to sense that there is a competition going on. Governments are starting to feel this competition. Anyway, so then I went to Estonia, same trip, and I had promised my friend Tony Perkins that I would speak at his Always On, I don't know whether it was Always On, his Venture Summit conference in Palo Alto. And it was the same day as Skype's first board meeting in Estonia. And I said, Tony, I don't know if I can do this. Maybe we can do it by video conference. And at that time, visit conference sounded like this. And he said, gee, okay, well, let's try it. And to his credit, he said, let's try it. And hey, and can you get that guy, Nicholas Zennstrom, who's starting that company, and do a little interview with him? That might be kind of fun from Tallinn to here. I said, sure, and we'll get, you know, a telephone backup just in case this thing doesn't work. So I go to Nicholas, and I said, Nicholas, do you want to do this video conference interview? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, you know, we've been working on something in the lab. And I said, that's great. At that time, it was just phone. It was just free phone service, and it was there were about 3 or maybe 5 million users. And he said, yeah, we've been playing around with video. And I said, well, that's great, you know, but okay. And he goes, yeah. And I said, okay, well, will you set up a video conferencing system here? And he goes, yeah. And then just before we're about to get on, he goes, okay, throw the switch. And I said, what do you mean throw the switch? And he goes, we're shutting off all the phone service so that we can get really good bandwidth so that our video comes through perfectly. And it turns out it did, and there was somebody from eBay in that audience, and there was also somebody from Microsoft in that audience, and it may have turned out that that's why Skype was sold. Now, I take you to Egypt, but not because I've done anything interesting there, except I did take a nice trip down the Nile, and there were some terrorists, so we had to take a bus around some area or whatever. But what's really cool is that technology has overthrown a bad government. And so technology is going to force governments to become democracies, and that is really, really exciting. And that's actually what Yushchenko in Ukraine was put in power by. It was the Orange Revolution, and the Orange Revolution was done with instant messaging. And it turns out Egypt's revolution was done with Twitter and Facebook. So technology really is winning all the wars. Now, something else is happening. Countries are starting to compete for the great minds in the capital of the world. So here it says, Chile wants your poor, your huddled masses, your tech entrepreneurs. Well, the whole world is looking at it this way. They're saying, hey, we want you to come here. As a venture capitalist, I'm getting attracted by all these other countries. The deputy prime minister of Vietnam said, you know how China did it? Well, we're going to do it better. And Singapore says, I went to Singapore and I said to somebody that, you know, maybe there's an opportunity to create this, you know, one big corporation. And so it was sort of a new kind of stock market. And that was at breakfast. And by lunch, he had the head of the Singapore SEC to my left and the head of the Singapore stock market to my right. And they are really very anxious to do more business like that. In Korea, he's a very solid businessman, this President Lee, and he has he also encouraged me to bring my business to Korea. It's happening all over the world. People are recognizing, a little less so in Europe, they're a little slow to react, but they're recognizing that they need to attract the great minds, the capital, and the businesses of the world, or people will leave their countries. And so they aren't geographic borders anymore. There's a new kind of governance coming along, and it's combination cyberspace and attraction for business. It's interesting. And so you see these countries like Russia that really is not very comfortable talking about it. Medvedev is now talking about rule of law, and he's talking about bringing entrepreneurs in, and he has this Skokovo, this big thing that he's calling the Silicon Valley of Russia. Interestingly, he said in his speech, he said, markets are like parachutes. They're best when they're open. And then the Russian guy next to me whispers, and he goes, both of those are going down. You know, there's this cynical thing in Russia that is really fun. And he gave this speech that was so pro-capitalist, so pro-business, that you got this feeling that Russia is really trying to move in that direction. And I think he and Putin are sort of the yin and the yang. Putin keeps himself occupied with the older group and Medvedev with the younger group. So it should be fun to see how that evolves. But anyway, countries are competing for the great minds and capital of the world. Turns out states are too, and California's losing. Texas is winning. You got to do something about that. You got to balance your budget, and you've got to lower your taxes, and you got to do things to attract these businesses. California does get away with having a really nice climate and a great ocean and great mountains, though. So they're allowed to sort of stretch it a little on the government side. Now I give you a quick overview of Draper Fisher Jurvetson. We saw this happening because of Hotmail. We opened our minds to the idea that geographic borders were going to fall and businesses were going to spread. And with the information economy and the internet economy, we recognized that businesses could be started anywhere and grow all the way around the world. I mean, now there are, what, 2 billion people connected to the internet and 3 billion people connected by cell phone. The world is getting connected, and that's going to be a great thing. Anyway, we manage about a total of about $7 billion, and we have core funds, and then we have this global network because we decided that we couldn't be everywhere, and so we set up a network of venture capitalists so that we can have this information coming to us in a lot of different places. You can see there's still some gray areas here on the earth. In Africa, in the Middle East, Australia, Canada, and Spanish-speaking South America, and we're going after those too. We don't have any immediate plans for Antarctica, but otherwise we're going to make sure we're covered so that entrepreneurs can be funded anywhere. Now, innovation is interesting. This chart shows that this is Moore's Law, and it shows that $1,000 worth of compute power doubles every 18 months. Now, it turns out it's now doubling every 12 months. So every year, compute power is twice as powerful or half the cost, or it's better, it's faster, it's cheaper. And so every year or two, we're going to have a new platform from which new entrepreneurs can create something that will spread to a ever-growing population of users. So people say, well, nothing will ever be bigger than Microsoft. Well, maybe Google is. Nothing will ever be bigger than Google. Well, maybe Facebook will be. Each of these companies continues to be bigger than the one before and grows faster than the one before. So if you hit it right, it'll spread all the way around the world, and you will have billions, potentially billions of users of whatever it is that you create. So if that is the case, we have accelerating technology. You think about all the inventions that have happened in the last 150 years. The light bulb, the toilet, the radio, automobile, television, jets, the pill, the bomb, microwave, ICs, satellites, photocopier, space travel, computers, email, fiber optics, biotech, cell phones, MRIs, internet, digital cameras, web browsers, search engines, smartphones. Where would we be without this stuff? The world has changed a lot in the last 150 years. Imagine the squalor people lived in 150 years ago. And now fast forward another 15 years. Not 150 years, 15 years. The same amount of change will happen in the next 15 years that has happened in the last 150 years. We humans are going to have to adapt faster and faster and faster to change. The world will change faster than it ever has before. So imagine desalinated water everywhere, near infinite energy supply at a very low cost. Imagine self-navigating electric cars. Imagine flying self-navigating electric cars. Interactive education. I really do believe that my kids learned a lot more from the internet than they did in the classroom. Now, they learned a lot from their friends, but that was different. That was a different kind of learning. You know, there could be a cure for heart disease, cancer, AIDS, malaria. There could be non-invasive surgery. So they just sort of see you and fix you. There could be non-invasive security. You know, now we did a company called SafeView. You walk through the thing that looks like a metal detector, and the guy on the other side of the curtain sees you completely naked. There are all sorts of applications for that. New life forms. food drop. I always, when I was a little kid, I was running around. I was always hungry, and I never wanted to stop doing what I was doing. So I always felt like, can't I just have like food drop, you know, drop into my hand so I could, you know, move forward and keep doing whatever I was doing. So who knows? And then 2 years after that, there will be the same amount of change that may have happened for the last 150 years. We're going to have to adapt to time travel wormholes and transporter beams and holodecks and a cure for death. Now, that's interesting, a cure for death. We are actually living, we've lived, back 150 years ago, we were living 24 years. You'd kind of learn for 12 and work for 12. Now, we're living, whatever, 80. It turns out that every 3 years, we're living another year. So if you live 3 years, you get one free. Anyway, there may be a death cure, and then we've really got to figure it all out. And then I think we'll colonize Mars. And that's not too out there. Elon Musk has a very good plan to do it. Everybody thought he was crazy with doing a sports car that was all electric, and turns out that thing is faster and more efficient and more powerful than any sports car under $1 million. And he also helped start PayPal, and he did SpaceX, which is kind of interesting. I'll get to something there. So for you, how do we become big? What are some of the things that people think about in starting big businesses? What is it? Well, think in terms of starting a revolution. And the way I think about a revolution is, think of things that have always been the way they are. The post office. And things that you thought would always be that way. The post office. Ma Bell. Trade. The neighborhood. Research, advertising, libraries, these things were always there. They were always a part of our lives growing up. I didn't think any of them would change. And all of a sudden, Hotmail came along and just changed the whole nature of what sending a letter is. Skype came and turned the whole telecom industry on its ear. eBay changed trade, the whole way we think in terms of trade. Facebook changed the neighborhood. My son, Billy, I asked, well, why don't you out playing with your friends? And he said, well, I am. They're right here. And it turns out they're all in the virtual world out there, and that virtual world is getting to be a bigger and bigger part of our lives. And then Baidu and Google changed the whole nature of what media is, advertising is. These companies have totally overthrown the status quo. I did say overthrow the status quo once before, and somebody came to me with a great country and western song. Gotta overthrow the status quo. This, by the way, is what the post office used to look like, a bunch of trucks that would carry things around. And this, for those of you who are much younger than I am, this is what a telephone was. You actually dialed with your finger. You moved your finger around in circles. This is what advertising used to be. It was all Madison Avenue, one street in New York. Defense contractors were generally all based on, defense contractors here, but what I'm saying is rockets were all done by government. And what's really interesting is Elon Musk came up with SpaceX, and for $40 million, he can launch what NASA spent $400 million on, the exact same payload. And $4 billion if you include all the overhead and all the planning and all of that. So what's interesting is that we all know that the private sector really can make things really happen a lot better than the public sector can because of that drive, that incentive, that ownership that you take when you are running a private sector company. Utilities have been completely changed by the nature by companies like Enernoc and Silver Spring that become smart grids, that they help the utilities become smart grids so that the utility doesn't have to fire up an extra nuclear power plant so that we don't have a blackout. These guys actually switch on power when power needs are the greatest, and they get paid the most. Another way to build a big business is to solve a problem. And problems come a lot when you, if you think about a problem, it's usually there's a politician saying, we've got a, and like a healthcare problem. With a healthcare problem, Hippocrates went and they helped solve this healthcare problem. Doctors can now, on a handheld, do very quick searches on what drugs are needed for what things, that kind of thing. There's a big energy problem, and companies like SolarCity and renewable funding have gone after it as a big opportunity to change the way energy is created. There's a transportation problem. We now have there's a Tesla out there. There's a war problem. Well, I think the solution for war is really communications, and I think our communication systems continue to improve and make it so that the idea of going to war with anybody makes no sense at all, because we would be, all of our businesses are so intertwined, it'd be like shooting yourself in the leg. Then the last piece of starting a great business, I think, is the zero business model. Think about how you can take a balance sheet and an income statement and put as many zeros in there as you possibly can. Well, not sales, not cash, not profit, but everywhere else. Think about what Amazon did. Amazon got rid of inventory and accounts receivable, and they changed the whole nature of what a bookstore was. Parametric was very unique in that they had a really good engineer and a very good team, and they held that to 3% of their costs. And if you could lower your costs, your engineering costs, to 3%, you got a lot more for marketing. And now that I mentioned marketing costs, Hotmail and companies like that with viral marketing can actually spread their product without paying a dollar in marketing. And so there's another potential zero. And so I want one more comment about the companies that become great for 60 years or more, the GEs and the Procter & Gambles and the IBMs and HP maybe, they're cheap. So if you're running a business, run it cheap, because you're going to have cycles. Things are going to go well for you for a while, and then they're not going to go so well. But if you're cheap all the way through, you'll keep that company alive when times are tough, so that the engineering team can come up with something new to ship out to the marketplace. And then be the best at what you can do. Go out there, and because if you're number one, it's a big difference than being number two. You'd much rather be Facebook right now than, I don't even know what number two is now. And always remember that technology wins. Technology wins all wars. Technology wins all businesses. So focus on technology. It's going to change faster and faster and faster, and we should be on top of it. So go out there and change the world. Thank you very much. Remember, entrepreneurs are heroes. Entrepreneurs take long odds at extraordinary outcomes. They take social risk, financial risk, career risk, and go out and do something that none of us has seen done before. So anyway, thank you very much for your tolerance, and I hope we have still some time for questions.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the presentation. I had enough time to read some of your writings. Are you able to hear me okay, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay. And there was a couple of things that really struck me. And one was you wrote about we're now, in your calculation, 3 years into a VC wave. And I think you called it the Draper Wave. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Draper Wave was something I put together because our investors were getting impatient with us. They were seeing all these great companies. They were getting better and better and better, and there was no liquidity. And so I started to think about, well, why is this? Why is there no liquidity? And then back in 1999, there was tons of it. And, you know, and then I remembered times before in 1976 where there was a lot of liquidity. And so I put together this chart, and it turns out that the venture capital business rises for about 8 years, and then it comes to sort of a frenzy, and then it comes crashing down. Although a long time ago, it was a venture capital business with my grandfather and like three other guys. But and then the private equity business, defined as either conglomerates merging and cutting half their workforce and levering up, or LBOs, or what they called private equity for the last 10 years, comes along and makes businesses more efficient. And that happens for about 8 years. And as they get more efficient, they come down. There's this boom for a while. And then when somebody says, whoa, we're way too highly leveraged, the market comes crashing down and we have a recession. And then people lose their jobs. And then they go start businesses. And then the venture capital business starts kicking in. And jobs get created. They get created very slowly at first, and we're in those years now. And then they get created in a frenzy, and then it swings to where the power swings to the employees, and they can choose where they go. And then you get another big bubble or another pop, and it comes crashing down, and you got another 8 year cycle where the financial guys come in there and they make it all more efficient. And that's, it's happened four or five cycles in my lifetime, and I expect it to happen again, which means that we're like 3 years into an 8 year cycle, and I'm expecting an enormous boom in this valley and around the world.
Thank you. There seems to be some fundamental changes over the last couple of years in how young companies are being funded. So not only young companies, but all along the corporate development life cycle. So IPOs are being delayed. M&A for a while was supreme. Investing on A rounds became more rarefied. Not as many VCs were doing it, driven by perhaps several different factors. Could you talk a little bit about how you've seen VC investing change and whether you think it's a fundamental change that's here to stay or something that will be more intermittent?
Yeah, I actually see a couple of things here. first, there was a lack of liquidity for the last 10 years, and so venture capitalists had a hard time justifying their fees and their carry to their investors. And that was not because they weren't making good investments. They were making very good investments. And those companies were growing, and there wasn't much capital available. And there's a reason for all that. What's interesting is that Sarbanes-Oxley, while it made it so that we had confidence in the stock markets again because it was quickly done, It had a huge ripple effect to small business. It's like a $4 million expense on any company that wants to go public. And so now I actually think that this company that my son is a part of called Expert Financial has alleviated this problem because we can take companies out. We can take them public through this Expert Financial, through this XPO that they have, as a stepping stone to going public, and it creates a new value on those companies. Investors can feel more confident about what stock prices are worth, and I think it's very similar to what the Four Horsemen did in the last cycle to create more liquidity for venture capitalists so that they could take that money, send it back to their investors, And then the investors would reinvest in them, and then they, in turn, could invest in more entrepreneurs. And so this is, I think, a great solution and a great way for us to get more liquidity, and I think it's going to create that next boom. It's going to help create that next boom. Now, the other thing you hit on was, have venture capitalists changed? I don't know if they have, but they have to react to market effects. And the market effects that are very interesting are these incubators that are happening everywhere and these angels that are coming in and funding them with open-ended valuations. It gets a little tricky for a venture capitalist to go in and figure out what the company's worth after it's already taken money from an angel. And the prices have gone up a lot. So stock prices have gone up a lot. And they've gone up sort of at two ends, at the angel side and at the pre-IPO side. I think they have yet to rise in the middle. And I think once this expert financial starts taking off, they are going to rise in the middle.
So you don't see expert financial, secondary markets, share posts displacing the VCs. You see them at more supplemental.
Oh, absolutely. They actually help VCs with deal flow and liquidity, and I think they're actually going to be very helpful to the venture world in general. I think we are going to see a big boom. I feel it. In fact, there was a lot of traffic here. I almost didn't make it, guys, but you know, there was a lot of traffic because I think there's activity again. Yes. I think things are happening here.
I don't want to spend too much time here, but there was a question or two, and I did read a recent blog of yours about unionism, your experience in Paris. And so
I encourage everybody. It was a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's fun.
But then I also read about Nike, now the owner of Converse, in trouble, or at least getting bad press about some of the sweatshops that their subcontractors are using in Indonesia. So it seems on one hand, unions in a more developed economy, perhaps, have run their course but are still needed. Can you talk a little bit about your feelings about unions and opportunity?
Yeah, I believe that unions had a very important role back when people had very difficult jobs and they had no way of negotiating with their bosses. And they were in steel mills or whatever, and there was no way to negotiate a deal. Well, now you can go to your boss and say, hey, the guy down the street just made me a better offer, and I think I might just go take it. And that negotiation can happen because there's more fluidity to jobs, and our jobs are much more based on information and communications than they were in the past. I still believe that it does make some sense to have unionism in the very difficult manufacturing jobs and in the very tough farm jobs, but there is no reason to have a union for government employees. There is no reason to have a union for teachers. There is no reason to have a union for, you know, anybody in the information and technology world. They can move. There is flexibility. People can move from job to job to job. And so I do believe that and unions killed the auto industry, the union management negotiation killed the auto industry in the U.S. until Tesla came along. And it's now unions are actually, in some ways, killing, say, California, and they're killing the U.S. because they have a very strong sort of a stranglehold over our government. And it almost doesn't matter who gets elected. It doesn't matter who our president is. It doesn't matter whether he's a Democrat or Republican or she's a Democrat or Republican. I don't think they have any power because the president's in there for, you know, the union guy sits there and he goes, yeah, you'll be here for, what, 4 years, maybe eight? You got some really good ideas there. Very interesting. But I'm here forever. You will never get rid of me.
So whoever wrote this question, I hope you appreciate how well I set it up. And that is, do you believe that there will be investment opportunity when governments begin to outsource some of the things they've been accustomed to doing? Fire, police, libraries, DMV, etc.
I think there is a huge opportunity in competitive governance. I think that is going to be enormous. I think that will fall into the category of better education through the cyber world. That'll fall into category of a DMV experience that is all done online. It'll fall into category of more privatizations where, you know, you turn NASA into a university or Ames into a university, or there are going to be a lot of very interesting opportunities out there that recognize that governments are in competition with one another, and you can be much more efficient in government because of computers.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. The government of Chile apparently has a startup Chile program, which offers approved entrepreneurs $40,000, no strings attached. Are you aware of this program, and what do you think?
I think it's great. And actually, Sebastian Piñera stayed in our guest room before he became the president, and we had a long talk about entrepreneurship and how venture capital worked. And he is trying to start that there. And he's doing it in a great way because the whole world now knows about his program and his – how many people in Chile? 30 million people? His 30 million people are all going to benefit if the rest of the world recognizes that there are going to be a lot of great entrepreneurs coming to Chile. I think he's figured it out.
All right. So one of the problems with starting up a company in countries other than the U.S. and maybe a few select others – is the protection of IP. When you talk to global leaders, do you talk to them about how important it is to protect IP? And would you like to make a comment about that?
Yeah. This is an interesting situation. The media companies have had end-to-end control over the artists and the customer of the artists. And they are putting a lot of pressure on governments to make sure that they continue to have that end-to-end control. But all of a sudden, there's iTunes, and we've got music going right to the customer, and there isn't the only middle person is, you know, Steve Jobs and Apple Computer, and there are plenty of opportunity for competition. And so when a big industry like that has a lot of pressure on it, it does a lot of lobbying. And so you hear a lot about IP protection from those media industries. Now, our patent law was a great thing because people could work very hard, come up with something, and have power over that that invention for a 7 to 17 year time. And that has been a very good source of innovation here in our country. There are some problems now because the big drug companies and the government have made it so that it is so expensive and so convoluted to put a new drug on the market that the small businesses have – if you created a cure for cancer right now, it would be 15 years in the making and it would cost you $200 million to get to the shelves. And a lot of that is how tough FDA approval is, the patent law office is. There are a lot of things that have been set up by big companies who could afford to have lobbyists to go to government and make the laws that work for them so that the small businesses kind of look and go, wait, where did all these laws come from? All of a sudden – I'm in a small business investment company program, and that has been a great thing for America, for everybody, for a long time. But they keep coming up with new laws, and they make it harder and harder for us to comply, and that benefits the big business. That creates more and more monopolies. And monopolies are not good for competition, and they're not good for the consumer, and they're really not good for any of us. And they're really not good if they're like American monopolies where some other country can come along and just snag a market. So I would say, you know, we've got some real work to do in making the not just the IP protection, but making it so we're free to innovate. We're free to create new things without feeling like we're going to get sued by some big company that has more patent protection than we do. And I think a big thing is go after the unions and go after the corporate lobbyists. You put those two, you do both those things, and our country will soar again. We'll see GDP growth of 7% again.
Yeah, just to ring out any further thoughts you have about that, let me ask you, if you were to receive a call from the president tonight or the head of the Republican Congressional caucus, and they were going to ask you what other things you would do to promote innovation and entrepreneurship in the U.S., are there other messages?
You know, I think I think those two messages are my strongest. I would say we need to take away the power of the government employee unions, and we need to take away the power of the big corporations, because they are the ones who can afford to go talk to this government in Washington, 3,000 miles from here, and change the rules so that we all have to play by those rules. And that, I think, would be probably the biggest thing we could do to encourage great entrepreneurship in the world. Now, there are a couple of other things. We do have a very good, very competitive, best in the world higher education system. Now, don't get me started on the lower education system, but the higher education system is the best in the world. We can go to state schools, we can go to state universities, we can go to private schools, we can do so many different choices, and it's the best education in the world. And everybody in the world knows it. So they come here to the U.S. and they say, I'm going to Stanford, I'm going to Harvard, this is great. And then they come to Stanford and they go, this is great. I'm going to live here. And they're like PhD in electrical engineering at 14 years old, or they're the brightest computer scientist that has come out of Stanford in years. And then our government says, well, no, you can't work here. You can't live here. You can't work here. You don't have a green card. What's a green card? Just make a card that's green. If I think that if we have a master's, if we have anybody who comes to the U.S. and does a technology master's degree should have a green card stapled to their diploma. It should be here. You are here. We love you. Stay, please. But what we're doing is we're bringing them in. We're kicking them out. Now, part of that's great. Part of it is taking these people, educating them to the best of your ability, and sending them out to do great things in their own countries. And so there is some real value to that, and it's wonderful. But if you're thinking in terms of being the president of the United States, you're responsible for the United States. You're not responsible for the growth of the world. You start stapling those green cards to master's degrees.
So I've had the pleasure over the years of being a judge in Northern California on the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Awards, really a fabulous program. And then each year they identify 10 different industries or sub-industries, and, And there are, you know, two or three finalists for each. And at the end, there's 10 winners of the Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Invariably, 7 or 8 of the 10 are non-mother tongue English people. They're from India, they're from Asia, they're from Eastern Europe. And maybe there's one or two guys that, you know, I could have grown up next to. Speak a little bit about that. Aside from the fact that we should have put a green card on their master's degree, maybe some of them we did. But why is it that these people that are coming from outside the United States are the ones that are the leaders in the technology innovation today?
Well, here they are. And Parametric was a Russian immigrant. Hotmail was an Indian immigrant. Baidu was a Chinese immigrant. Tesla, SpaceX, and SolarCity were all South African immigrants. Yeah, I think it's cool that the immigrants are doing so well here. Now, why aren't the domestic Americans doing so well? Now, when I was growing up here in California, California's public schools were number one in the country. And now we are number 49 or 50. Our math scores are just above Guam and just behind Mississippi. And what happened? What happened? That's one generation, maybe a generation and a half. It went from the best. California was the best, and California created a lot of really great companies, HP, Intel, Hewlett-Packard is HP, it turns out. All of the spin-outs, all of that, and those were Californian natives. And then what happened? Well, I believe, and I worked very hard on this, that our education system in California is the worst in the world because we are not a competitive education system. We're a monopoly. It's, you know, they allow a few of these charter schools to exist. They allow a few of these private schools to exist. But basically, it's all public schools. The charter schools, even the charter schools, are ultimately run by the Department of Education. And we have a lazy monopoly running our schools. And it's union-based. And it's not, you know, the average school teacher in California was in the 25th percentile on the SAT. And who wants to be a teacher? You go in, some of these great teachers come in, they say, I'm going to teach. And then they face this line of teachers saying, well, they say, okay, and I'm going to teach from 8 to 5 because I know that these parents have to work from 8 to 5, these moms have to work from 8 to 5. And the union comes in and says, you will work from 8 to 3. You will not work those extra 2 hours. We have negotiated your contract. You will work from 8 to 3. Okay, there's another thing. You can't fire a teacher. There's a principal. I talked to this principal, and he said, I have finally fired a teacher. And I said, that's fantastic. How did it go? What happened? Well, he was a pedophile. And I say, well, you must have been able to get rid of him really easily. And he goes, no, it cost the state $1 million. And it took me 2 years. And we had to go through all this court stuff. And we had to hire a private lawyer because the union had really strong lawyers. But I said, finally, well, you got rid of him. That's great. He goes, yeah. But then he showed up in the district next door. And I said, what? Oh, that's horrible. He goes, oh, no. This is the dance of the lemons. Happens all the time. I just thought, oh, my gosh. And that's how I got started on the school voucher campaign. But I was just totally outgunned. I didn't know, you know, politics from you know, a hole in the wall. And I think we have a serious problem here in California. They have a huge problem in New York, a huge problem in Washington, D.C., we are not competitive. Our schools aren't competitive. So if you really want to start, have great companies start in your backyard with your locals, you've got to work on the schools.
So a very specific question for you, and then one last question. I have a number of people out in the audience want to know, what is your sweet spot? What kind of deals do you want to take a look at? And is there a particular stage of corporate development they need to be at in order to be appealing to you?
Yeah, for me personally, I believe in that Moore's Law. I believe that the platforms are going to change every year, every 2 years. And so I'm looking for companies that are thinking so far out that Moore's Law will catch up to them when they finally get their first customers and when they finally start growing, so that they're really thinking 5 to 7, maybe even 8 years out when they come to me with their idea. So when somebody comes to me and says, hey, we got a better social network, I'm kind of looking and saying, you know, that's been done. But if somebody comes to me and I don't quite understand what they're talking about, then I start listening. Because they are in a new space, in a new world, trying to project out to what potentially could happen over the next 5 to 7 years. I'm also looking for people who are so enthusiastic and so driven that nothing will stop them. And if I don't invest, it doesn't matter. It's going to happen anyway. And they've just got it in their heads, and they're just taking it step by step. They're just going after it step by step. And if I don't, you know, it's sort of like, oh, you're an investor? Oh, yeah, get on the train because it's going. And if you want to get on the train, if you don't want to, go. Too bad. I've got this plan. This is where I'm going. And I don't care if I make money. I don't care if anybody makes money. I do want them to ultimately make money. I ultimately want to make money. But all I really care about is all of the world should see this.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we have reached that point in the program where we have time for just one last question. And I don't know if I should apologize in advance for this question, but I just can't help myself. What were you thinking when...
No, stop there.
When in April you bought a hotel, the Benjamin Franklin Hotel.
Okay, so very good question. My wife grew up in Hillsborough, in San Mateo, and she loved that hotel. That hotel has fallen apart. I'm looking around. Real estate values are very low. I'm optimistic that California will fix their budget. I hope they do. I'm optimistic that things might just turn. I think the world's coming back here. And so I thought, well, I'll just make a real estate purchase. Now that I've made it, I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to do with it. But it's driven my creativity again, and I'm having fun with it. And we're going to figure out what it's going to be. And so ultimately, you might see something very unique happening there, or maybe it's just another hotel.
Well, thank you. I hope you all have enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Tim Draper, founder and managing director of Draper Fisher Jurvetson and managing director of DFJ Global Networks, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned. Good night. That's right.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.